The Congressional Budget Office buzzkills Thursday and using crowdfunding to build skyscrapers. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, March 30th. Thanks for being with us. We begin today with a grim report from the Congressional Budget Office. It predicted that the budget deficit and government debt will skyrocket over the next 30 years. That assumes no change in how much the country spends and takes in. A big part of the problem? The huge wave of retiring baby boomers going on Social Security and Medicare. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes it from here.
Every day, about 10,000 baby boomers retire.
The trajectory that's projected for Medicare expenses is pretty scary.
That's Carl Tannenbaum, chief economist for Northern Trust. And he's right. The CBO says U.S. public debt will soar to 150% of GDP, our total economic output, by 2047, largely because of increases in Medicare and Social Security costs. So, what to do about this? Tannenbaum says Americans are living and working longer.
So adjustments to the retirement age in some cases, I think, would also help put the system on a road to solvency.
He's talking about raising the retirement age. But June O'Neill says, hang on, you may not have to do that. O'Neill is a former CBO director who now teaches economics at Baruch College. She says because baby boomers are living and working longer, these dire predictions might be off track.
If they're working longer, then there's more income coming in. So that enters the pot of the money that's paying for the programs.
So those working boomers' taxes help pay for their Social Security and Medicare benefits. But Lawrence Kotlikoff, an economics professor at Boston University, says, listen, none of this stuff will make a dent in Social Security and Medicare spending. He says even limiting Social Security and Medicare benefits for wealthier seniors wouldn't do the trick.
Most of these things that are being considered or discussed are too little too late. You really need a very fundamental reform to fix the system for good.
Kotlikoff says we need to overhaul the way Social Security is funded and make Medicare more like managed care. Huge changes, he acknowledges, politicians are reluctant to support. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer. Marketplace.
One emerging storyline from the new administration is that the FCC has a lot more influence than you might have expected, like over TV stations, old school ones, not cable or Hulu. And companies that own lots of TV stations have been blocked from merging or buying more. That's because the FCC limits how much of the audience any one company can control. But next month, that might all change. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
UHF. It was an 80s movie with Weird Al Yankovic, where a scrappy TV station gets big ratings through borderline abusive kids programming.
You get to drink from the fire hose!
Back then, UHF signals like Channel 13 or 24 didn't go as far as your Channel 2 or 6. So when the FCC asked whether a company controlled too much of the TV market, UHF stations didn't count for as much. But then digital TV made all stations equal, so the FCC counted them the same. That limited growth for big TV groups. But next month, the FCC could vote to go back to giving companies what's called the UHF discount. Blair Levin was once with the FCC. Now he's a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
If they're allowed to get bigger on a national basis, they will have increased leverage with both suppliers and distributors.
They could bargain for better prices on programming. Would bigger TV station conglomerates mean less local focus? Justin Nielsen with S&P Global Market Intelligence says maybe not.
You're actually seeing more capital being spent on local news and programming because these station groups are able to do that.
But Aram Sinreich at American University says more consolidation means less diversity.
Is it just Coke versus Pepsi, or do you want to have all kinds of funky, wonderful, different flavors that you've never tried before? Right? It's going to amount to the same thing on television.
You flip from channel to channel, but since they have the same owner, you're drinking from the same fire hose. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the dollar and the Dow both trended up. We will have the details when we do the numbers. A little more from Washington, where Ivanka Trump has officially become an unpaid assistant to the president. She has a West Wing office and a security clearance, and the clearance sounds like a big deal. But if anything about it is notable, it's that she practically broke the land speed record getting it. As Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, security clearances aren't quite as special as people may think.
There's a whole segment of the job market reserved exclusively for people with security clearances. Evan Lesser is president of ClearanceJobs.com, which lists about 25,000 openings.
I think most people think of security clearance jobs, they immediately think of James Bond, you know, cloak and dagger kind of stuff. But in reality, the bulk of clearance jobs are pretty ordinary.
Think IT and accounting, office jobs that typically don't call for jumping out of a plane. Peter Godomsky is a research physical scientist with the Army Corps of Engineers, and while he may not be James Bond, his job is pretty cool.
We do kind of snow and ice science, snow hydrology, and then glaciology.
But there are some projects Godomsky can't do because they involve data or facilities that require a security clearance. So he filed for one last fall. The form is more than 100 pages long.
I did have to spend probably a day and a half in terms of filling out paperwork, figuring out where I've lived for the past 10 years, which has been a lot of different places.
Then there are the interviews with you, your friends, people you forgot you knew.
Occasionally I'll hear of a friend or former coworker who's gotten interviewed. Those are like one every 2 months or so.
Little wonder that there's a backlog of about 500,000 pending investigations. The waiting time is usually anywhere from a couple of months to a couple of years. Only now, things are moving even slower. Eric Hu works for a defense contractor.
It just takes a lot longer during administration years because there's usually a large influx.
And presidential hires get to cut the line. Hu says he has a chicken and egg problem. He can only hire people with clearances, but you can't get a clearance unless you already have a job that needs one. So he focuses on people who are already cleared.
We mostly look towards either military reservists, retired military, current contractors, or current civilian employees.
A clearance can cost anywhere from a couple of $1,000s for a low-level one to more than $10,000 for top-secret access. And employers pick up the tab. But the payoff isn't quite what it used to be. Here's Evan Lesser from Clearance Jobs again.
You know, 5 or 6 years ago, most security clear professionals were able to command an average of 10 to 20% more in salary than their most equivalent non-cleared counterpart.
He says the tight job market has started to level the playing field. Even so, having a security clearance lets the world know the government thinks I'm trustworthy and patient. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The major movie studios are showing off their upcoming films this week in Las Vegas. At an event called CinemaCon, they're trying to get theater owners to book and promote their movies. But there is this tricky issue in the last few years over when to make movies available to the at-home audience. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill has the best beat in the company. She's been in Vegas watching movie trailers and eating candy all week. Hello, Adrienne.
Hey, Molly.
All right, so I am a cheapskate with a big TV. Talk to me about this back and forth between studios and theaters. What look do they both want?
I mean, they want money. Right now, there's this 90-day window between big movies coming out in the theaters and when they actually make it to you and your television screen. Studios want to shorten that time to basically allow people to pay a premium for being able to watch a movie at home much, much sooner. And the idea is that they could get more people watching and paying to watch more money for their movies. As you might imagine, this makes the theater owners crazy because they need people in seats. This is not a new conversation, but there does seem to be finally a growing consensus that something's got to give here. You know, we watch in different ways. We watch on different devices. There's a billion things to watch. And I think that it sounds like from the outside that the studios and theaters are really trying to come up with a plan that'll work and change things.
So did you hear anything, any specifics that you were able to uncover there?
You know, no.
What's going on?
We know the studios and exhibitors are talking to each other, but they're not doing too much talking to the press or in public. There are reports that the current discussions are sort of focusing around a month, maybe a month and a half, so shrinking that window. But we'll see. This is hard. It's contentious. And it's not just studios and theaters who disagree. It seems like some of the filmmakers, too. Yesterday, Warner Brothers did their studio presentation, and an exec got up and talked about, yes, we need to change this. We're figuring it out, how to grow the pie for everybody. And then minutes later, in the exact same presentation, Christopher Nolan basically threw cold water on the idea. Like, my movies are for theaters. I love theaters. So we're going to see if we can find a deal that works here for everybody.
So, okay, real quickly, let's get to the fun part. Any favorites? Any favorites?
Well, I'm going to give away something about myself. Fast and Furious is always a favorite. I'm excited for Fast and Furious. Knowing you, Molly, I'm going to go with the new Blade Runner. It also looks pretty cool. I have to imagine it's up your alley. But, you know, Hollywood is making escapist fare right now. Everyone is talking about escaping real life, sitting down in the dark, getting away from it all, being transported to another place. And that's really what this industry, especially right now, is about. And I have to admit, it sounds and actually is, because I do have the coolest beat ever, pretty nice.
All right, I'm game for some escapism. I might even pay to go to the theater. All right, thanks, Adrian.
Thanks, Molly.
Coming up,
people cheat, you know, and lie, and bricks don't.
Commercial real estate investing isn't just for moguls anymore. But first, let's do the numbers. They are up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 69 points at 0.3% to close at 20,728. The NASDAQ gained 16 points, more than a quarter percent, to finish at 5914. And the S&P 500 gained nearly 7 points, 0.2%, to close at 2368. Freddie Mac reports mortgage rates fell for the second straight week as long-term bond yields dropped to their lowest level in a month. Freddie Mac shed 1.5%. Fannie Mae gave away 1 1/10%. Wells Fargo gained about 0.1%. McDonald's says it's going to make its quarter pounders with fresh beef instead of frozen patties starting next year. McDonald's topped on 0.3%. Fresh beef competitor Habit spread on 1 3/10%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note was 2.242%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Hi, it's Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on Marketplace every day,
technology, the economy, culture, check out our weekly podcast, Make Me Smart. It's a chance to tell us the things you really want to learn more about and share with us the things you know more about than anyone else.
We're at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Molly is at Molly Wood. Check it out.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. When it comes to politics and race, athletes are starting to find their voices. Colin Kaepernick protesting the national anthem. The University of Missouri football team refusing to play until former President Tim Wolf resigned. Or former NFL player Anquan Boldin, whose cousin was shot and killed by police in Florida while he waited for roadside assistance. Boldin and another former player, Malcolm Jenkins, were on Capitol Hill this week lobbying directly for criminal justice reform. We spoke to them from our D.C. bureau, and the first question I asked Anquan, why lobbying?
We just figured out that, number one, the power that NFL players have. Number two, the platform that is afforded to us because of what we do. And who better to get in front of to advocate for change than senators and congressmen?
And so you're working on criminal justice reform. Malcolm, what would you say are your top priorities?
One of the things that we wanted to do is not only come here and voice, you know, our concerns of the system as it stands, but find out, you know, what are some things that are already being done and what we can lend our support to, like the Second Chance Act, like the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. Both of those have components that either reduce mandatory minimums, that help in reforming the criminal justice system and have bipartisan support, but for whatever reason hadn't been pushed through. And with the new administration, we want to make sure that this is actually part of the agenda and it's a high priority.
I think we all agree that in order to get anything done here in Washington, it has to be bipartisan. So we're trying to figure out what bills have the support of both parties so that we can help push those along. Because, I mean, just to be honest, there isn't one thing that we have to attack when it comes to criminal justice reform.
Is there anything that you have found in particular that there is pretty good agreement on? Because we don't hear a lot about agreement in Washington. So if you've seen anything, I want to know.
There is a consensus that, and everybody agreed that the system is broken and there needs to be reform. What exactly the reform is was a little noncommittal, but one of the messages that we received from them is that, you know, they deal with all kind of issues and topics. And so unless someone's here on Capitol Hill pushing constantly over time these agendas, then sometimes they get knocked down on the list of things that they have to get done.
Let's talk a little bit more about the power of the professional athlete, because I think we've seen just in the last, you know, year, a couple years, an increase. There's obviously Colin Kaepernick. There's the NBA pulling the All-Star game out of North Carolina. There's you guys doing this very public lobbying effort. Does this represent a little bit of a change, do you think? Are athletes starting to come into their power as social influencers?
I think guys are understanding the responsibility that they have, not only as athletes, but as citizens. And I think it's becoming important to us because we're affected by it. I think there's a lot of athletes out there that have a lot to say. I think there's a lot of athletes out there who wants to be heard. I think there are a lot of athletes out there that want to see change. Just because we're athletes don't mean we're exempt from the problems in this society.
When you look at the NFL, the NBA, the makeup of the demographics of those two entities, the majority of them are African-American. And so when you look at the criminal justice system and how it disproportionately affects the African-American community, these are all concerns that most of these players are dealing with either directly or indirectly through either their own personal experience or family or friends that are still in these communities. I think it's, like you said, it's a responsibility for us to use our platforms. And I think the more guys that recognize that, the more activism you'll see from athletes.
Anquan Boldin and Malcolm Jenkins, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Lots of people in this country are self-employed or working in small companies, and co-working spaces are popping up everywhere. These are often billed as flexible, communal workplaces where people can rent a desk by the day or month. But sometimes they're not flexible enough. From Pittsburgh, Erica Barris brings us this story.
Come on, Jamie, let's go in.
It's early morning, and Mary Jane McCullough is dropping her 14-month-old daughter off at daycare.
Can I have a big hug, Meg? Because now Mama's going to go, okay?
Then she walks through a set of doors and heads to her desk, where she starts her day running a language interpretation company. She used to do this at home.
Trying to work from home with kids is impossible. It's, you know, keeping my phone on, taking conference calls in the bathroom, you know, with kids screaming outside.
She's at the Whetstone, a co-working space just outside Pittsburgh that has childcare. Workers here pay $25 a day or $150 a month for desk space, access to copiers and scanners, and unlimited coffee. The childcare is extra. Jessica Strong opened the Whetstone just over a year ago when she couldn't find a flexible workspace in daycare. Turns out a lot of other women felt that way too. Nearly all 30 members here, she says, are moms.
It was intended to be for parents. It just happened that women are the ones that have left the workforce to try to be home more with their kids.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics says nearly 10% of the workforce is self-employed, and some of those workers want to work away from home. That's why co-working spaces keep opening up, some catering to women. They offer things like childcare and hair and makeup rooms. And McCullough says there are also networking opportunities.
I got connected with my business attorneys through this space. I got connected with my accountant through this space.
Dedicated spaces that market to women have opened in San Diego, Washington, D.C., New York. Only a few miles away from Whetstone in downtown Pittsburgh, there's another space that markets to women called Coterie. It's light and airy, and the decor resembles a day spa. A month membership costs $250. It's where Kate Stolfus goes to co-run a company that helps female entrepreneurs. She says it feels right.
We haven't felt as relaxed or at home in any other space.
Coterie is in an office building developed in 1902 by the famed industrialist Henry Clay Frick. It's located in the penthouse suite.
It's where Henry Clay Frick used to have his good old boys club. I guess it used to be a cigar lounge at one point. It was kind of his area to be with there with the boys. And I think it's really neat that now it's occupied by women.
Kind of like a really big room of one's own. In Pittsburgh, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
First co-working and now crowdfunding, which has exploded onto the scene since 2012, when the Federal Jobs Act changed the way individuals could invest in projects or in companies. Rodrigo Nino is founder and CEO of a platform called Prodigy Networks. It uses crowdfunding to build commercial real estate, such as the largest skyscraper in his home country of Colombia. Rodrigo, good to have you with us.
Very happy to be here with you.
Tell me how you got interested in this funding model and what it means to you.
Yes, essentially, crowdfunding means democratizing access, in our case, to large-scale commercial real estate assets. And this is possible because of the Jobs Act, which essentially opened up public solicitation to accredited investors. So in a way, it is public access to former private offerings, which is the first time it happens, you know, in over 80 years, since 1933, actually.
So how does it work for investors? They become a part of a project, and then are they then long-term investors with equity in that project?
That's correct. In our case, we chose commercial real estate in New York because we believe that it is the most liquid of all markets. And we also believe, you know, that it is the safest asset in crises. So we provide equity participation to smaller investors from all over the world and from all over the United States.
Now, when you describe it, it sounds like a slightly more complicated way to build a building. Do you find that it is easier, or is it more of a philosophical choice?
I have to say that it is different, because you would argue that traditional equity funding is easier because you deal only with one institution that gives you a check for the total equity that you require for a building, and you don't need to deal with thousands of investors like we do. On the other hand, the top-down approach was one of the bigger issues in the crisis of 2007. We learned, you know, that the model of giving your money to experts that would know better didn't work. So we like to believe, you know, that we act as curators of that collective wisdom of the crowd, and they need to understand what they do.
Right. And you also have been known to crowdsource designs, right? Building designs and architecture?
Yeah, we believe, you know, that if they can help us crowdsource the design based on what the needs would be, even better.
So you were early, obviously, one of the first to be doing this in the United States, if not the first. Do you see now there are hundreds of companies doing crowdfunding in some way. How do you see the model spreading and competition growing?
I think that the model will spread because this industry was ripe for disruption. You know, I think that the commercial real estate industry in the United States is even larger than the stock market. And now, thanks to technology and the Jobs Act, I believe that the public has access to an incredible asset, you know, because it's very understandable and very predictable. If you think about it, people cheat, you know, and lie, and bricks don't. So that was exclusive to a selected few, and now it is available to everybody.
Rodrigo Nino, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Crowdfunding has also become popular for personal expenses, whether it's education or disaster recovery or illness. GoFundMe is probably the best known name. Until today, Facebook, so many good ideas. Facebook just introduced a crowdfunding feature called personal fundraising. Facebook says it'll review each fundraiser to help keep fraud to a minimum. This final note before we go, Crayola will be making a major news announcement on a Facebook live stream tomorrow morning. Now, tomorrow, as it happens, is National Crayon Day, and Crayola will be introducing a new color. But this move is not without consequences. The company has a strict one-in, one-out policy, and it said today on Twitter that it's retiring the Dandelion crayon, otherwise known as dark yellow. So this new one better be good. I still can't believe they ditched mulberry for jazzberry jam. And that's it for us. An update on Wall Street. The Dow gained 69 points. The NASDAQ gained 16 points, more than 0.25%. And the S&P 500 gained nearly 7 points to close at 2368. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I am Molly Wood, and we are back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.